This is side two, or B, of the second tape, and we're going to be listening to a tape done by Jeff Rentz in Santa Barbara, an interview with a gentleman named James Norman. And we'll begin now.
Good evening once again, everyone. My guest tonight is one whom you will not soon forget. His name is James R. Norman, and he will tell you things tonight that will leave you stunned, amazed, and astonished. But above all, his story may leave you with the hope that there just might be a future for this country's morally forlorn, ruthlessly corrupt, and remarkably inept governmental process after all. James Norman is one of America's premier investigative journalists who puts his facts where many others place innuendo and hype. James Norman's articles appear in a number of publications, most notably in the current issue of Media Bypass magazine, in an article entitled, Congressional Retirees Leaving Voluntarily, and We Should All Believe in Mother Goose. I will now quote from the beginning of that article. One after another in recent months, big-name U.S. senators and representatives have announced that they are, quote, retiring. Since the last election, a record 45 members of Congress have decided not to run for re-election or have outright resigned from office. Not in 100 years has there been such an exodus, and it is not over. Dozens of other lawmakers and powerful governmental leaders are privately hinting that they may be leaving office soon. Nor are these departees the obscure backbench sitters. They are among the most powerful people in the most powerful government that has ever existed on the earth, with egos to match. Take a look at the list. Look at all the committee chairmen or ranking minority members who would be committee chairmen if the Democrats regained control. Look at the powerful committees or subcommittees they are on. Appropriations, rules, armed services, agriculture. Look at the startling last-minute withdrawal of retired General Colin Powell as a potential candidate for president, a job for which many pundits had him pegged as a shoo-in. Common sense and history teach that people with this kind of power, pay, and perks don't give them up easily or without good reason. Here now to expose the incredible real reasons for the rash of retirements is my guest tonight, James R. Norman. Jim, are you there?
Yes, hi, Jeff.
Good. How are you tonight?
Well, pretty good.
Good. Let's list some of the key congressmen, senators, politicians, and corporate executives, Jim, that have, quote, resigned or, quote, retired recently. And perhaps you might mention some of the excuses they have been given.
Well, it's a laundry list. It's as long as your arm.
It sure is.
Some of the most notable names in the first wave, there was Sam Nunn, former chairman of the House, for the Senate Armed Services Committee. Pat Schroeder, you know, ranking Democrat in the House. Mark Hatfield, the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. Alan Simpson, big-time Republican in the Senate. Then you have a whole slew of others. Paul Simon, Howell Heflin. Then you just had Bill Cohen from Maine, a senator from Maine, announced he's not running again. They're like dropping like flies.
Yeah, Claiborne Pell.
Yeah.
James Exxon.
Exxon, too, right.
And how many representatives from Congress? Just a whole raft of them.
Yeah, it's, I've lost track. In fact, since the story came out, there's been a dozen more or so, just since the story ran. The count is approaching 60 now, I think.
Yeah, what is the standard excuse that they're giving?
It's amazing. A bunch of these people have said, I want to go spend more time with my family. And then a bunch of others who have been interviewed on the TV talk shows and in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, they say, the tone of discourse in Congress is so uncivilized these days.
Right.
Nasty politics where you can't stand it now that the Republicans are in control.
Morally repugnant to them.
Yes, yeah. Of course, about a third of the retirees here are Republicans themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And look, things are no more nasty in Washington than they ever have been. I mean, it's always been politics. It's always been brutal.
Sure.
No, things just don't make... A lot of these people have just had no good excuse. They said, enough's enough. Time to go home. Been here long enough. I didn't want to do this all my life anyway.
Right. Well, Pat Schroeder, as you mentioned in the article, says she wants to give up her $133,000 a year job to be a writer.
Don't quit your day job to be a writer.
Right, right. And Nancy Kassebaum, very famous family behind her, Alf Landon, of course, wants to go back to, as you say, her little farmhouse on the prairie.
Yeah, she did a long interview with the New York Times, and the only plausible excuse she gave there in the story was, well, I've got this little farmhouse out there on a prairie in Kansas, I want to go back there. She's young, she's 62 or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. How about Alan Simpson? He was carping about he has to raise $10,000 a week just for re-election. It's too expensive and too draining on him.
Oh.
Isn't that sad?
How much would it cost you to, hand deliver a huge packet of propaganda to every person? I mean, and the fact of the matter is, he can raise $10,000 a week with a few phone calls. These people are sitting on a gravy train.
So the cost doesn't make it. I mean, it just isn't the problem to raise the money. People just don't walk away from these incredibly powerful, prestigious status positions without good reason.
That's right.
And your reasoning and your determined efforts to find out what happened has led us to an astonishing revelation here. What is really going on, James?
It basically boils down to somebody knows about their Swiss bank account.
Uh-huh. You mean there's graft and corruption and money going overseas without proper accounting?
Yes, I know. You're shocked that this could be happening. But in fact, yes, and it's not been that big a secret, but what's happened is that essentially a handful of guys, former intelligence community guys.
As in CIA?
CIA, NSA, the National Security Agency.
Sure.
There's a raft of...
Okay.
Of government intelligence agencies. Nobody has any idea how huge the intelligence community is in this country. But some of these people are just so fed up with the bipartisan corruption and payola that's been going on, they've just decided, in effect, to take things into their own hands.
How many, James?
I think it's just a handful of guys. I don't even know it specifically. I'm uh-huh. told it's a group of five guys. They call themselves the Fifth Column.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been dealing with, in particular, one of these guys, actually a couple of them, for about 8 months now.
Mm-hmm.
Their predictions have been eerily accurate. They've been telling me this is going to happen for months and months, and I said, oh, come on, this is silly. Boy, next thing you know, you've got, 50, 60 retirements from Congress. And it's like, what they've been telling me keeps coming true. There's no other explanation for this. And what they have said makes sense. It's internally consistent, and it's technologically feasible. This is what I'm learning from
yes.
a whole bunch of bank and computer people.
Right. Before we get into the computer aspect of it, were they ever naming names to you? Were these people saying, okay, Senator Simpson's going to announce his retirement, Schroeder's going to bow out? Was it a name kind of thing, or just a trend is coming, Jim Norman?
It was sort of a little of both. Mm-hmm. It was mostly the trend is coming, and then they'd say, well, you're going to see a lady out west soon.
Uh-huh.
Boing, there goes Pat Schroeder. Now you're going to see a fellow down in Alabama. Boing, there goes Tom Bevel, who's the king of pork, I think, was his nickname. And it was eerie, and, this whole thing with Colin Powell, they were telling me months and months of this, don't worry, Colin Powell ain't going to run for office. He ain't going to run for office.
Uh-huh.
There was a huge hoopla buildup for this thing. I mean, this was like a steamroller rolling downhill to get Colin Powell. I mean, the cover of Time, the cover of Newsweek. This guy was out there on the end of the springboard, and he decided to go home.
Yeah, you could almost feel the energy mounting. You're right. It was a big, massive effort to put him in there at one point, and all of a sudden, pop, the balloon is gone.
Right.
Amazing. Were you approached, or did you ferret out these sources yourself through mutual contacts?
Oh, the way this whole thing evolved is the most bizarre thing. I mean, it's like, I feel like a Woody Allen character who, stumbled into the midst of this huge thing that's going on, and I had no idea what I was getting into on this thing. I mean, look, I'm a business reporter. I've been a business reporter for 20 years.
Well, you wrote for Forbes magazine.
I was with Business Week for 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and I worked at Forbes as a senior editor at Forbes for 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There, I was doing, sort of heavy-duty financial investigative type stuff, and I got into looking at an oil company bankruptcy in Connecticut, which always smelled pretty fishy to me because there was no reason for this company to have been losing the money the way that it did. And in fact, when you go back and look at the funny oil trading going on, it was a front to funnel money to yet another oil company that was financing arms sales to Iraq during the 1980s. And turns out it was one of a number of covert arms funding mechanisms, money laundering systems that apparently were being run and set up. That led me into looking at the government's use of some particular particularly stolen software, which was also being sold to the Iraqis, it turns out, for use by their intelligence community. I said, now this is very bizarre.
What was the name of that software?
Well, it turns out there's been a long-running legal case in Washington involving a little company called Inslaw.
Sure, the Inslaw thing led to the death of Danny Casolaro and a lot of other problems.
Yeah, well, Inslaw was just one of many things that Danny was looking at. And he was also looking at arms sales. He was also looking at offshore bank accounts. And in fact, I think that's what was the proximate thing that led to his death, because, you know, he was found supposedly committed suicide, but in fact he had his wrist slashed like 12 times deep,
right,
to cut the tendon, in a motel room in Martinsburg, Virginia, which happens to be the home of a major IRS data facility.
Mm-hmm.
And my information is that he probably had gained access to some IRS data he wasn't supposed to have on some people who didn't want him to have it. So
all this stuff is going to Iraq. You know, I think we might just punctuate this with a note that a tremendous amount of intelligence data, arms, munitions, chemical and biological warfare components, if not the finished product, were going to Iraq throughout the mid-80s prior to Operation Desert Storm.
Oh, right.
It's amazing.
I mean, it dwarfed the Iran-Contra thing.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The Iran-Contra was just a sideshow.
That's right.
To what was coming to Iraq.
Exactly.
Huge amounts of armaments, all of which was technically illegal to export, which means somebody had to be getting kickbacks and money on this stuff.
Major money. We're going to take our first break, James Norman, right now, and come back and finish this story, this first part of it up, as we continue here at the end of the line. We're back with James Norman. We're talking about the incredible story of so many congressmen and senators retiring early, spontaneously almost, but there's a lot of things going on here that we're going to reveal to you in the next section or two, which will amaze you. Do not miss a word of it. All right, Jim, we're at the point where you're looking into this oil company in Connecticut that's losing lots of money.
All right, which turned out to be a front for arms sales to Iraq, and among the other stuff that was getting sold to Iraq by this Chilean arms dealer, Carlos Cardon, was software. For use by Iraq's intelligence community.
The Inslaw software.
It was, yes. What people believe was a derivative of the Inslaw software. It was originally called Promise. It was designed for tracking legal cases.
That's right.
Now, the thing about this software is that it was easily customized without having to rewrite all the code. You could just rewrite some stuff on the front end, and it would go track anything that you wanted it to track, which would make it greatly adaptable, particularly in an intelligence community use where you're developing elaborate files on people.
Yes.
It also, turns out, got customized for use in a banking system for tracking money, particularly in tracking it in the form of wire transfers. And it became extremely valuable in connection with a major intelligence effort this country undertook beginning in the early 1980s. It was called Follow the Money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an effort to surveil foreign banking transactions. And we've been doing this for, you know, since the early 1980s now.
Sure.
And it's probably one of the greatest intelligence coups ever accomplished on the planet. We've been scooping up vast amounts of data on money flows. And in fact, Bill Casey, former head of the CIA, he crowed that his crowning achievement of his time in the intelligence community was this establishment of what amounted to real-time surveillance of world money flows. Partly the way they did it was by installing bug software, bug computers, in most of the world's major banks, which the banks sort of, I think, knowingly accepted just because they had to. In
sure.
fact, if they wanted to do business in
sure.
New York, they sort of had to, you know, swallow and take this up. Some of them might not have understood just how elaborate the surveillance was, but the point is that there was this massive banking intelligence effort underway. And this we've got on a record from people who were involved in that during the Reagan administration.
Uh-huh.
Now,
okay.
To accomplish that, the National Security Agency, which is the signals intelligence arm of our government, used various front companies, cutouts, as they would be called.
Mm-hmm.
One of these companies, we've learned, was a company in Little Rock. Its name was Systematics. It was owned by Jackson Stevens, 100%.
You mean Arkansas?
Arkansas.
A right. coincidence, if there ever was one.
Yeah. This was a company, a small company for bank data processing, but somehow or other, it ended up, especially in the late 1980s, landing contracts all over the world to install banking software.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very curious. One of the key interface people between Systematics and NSA was Vincent Foster,
mm-hmm.
who was, you know, a chief lawyer at the Rose Law Firm.
Sure.
More than a lawyer, he was a deal guy for mm-hmm. Jack Stevens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton was an attorney of record for Systematics. She represented that company in a key 1977 legal case in which Jack Stevens, on behalf of the BCCI crowd,
mm-hmm.
tried to take over a Washington bank holding company, which later became First American, you know, run mm-hmm. by Clark Clifford and Robert Altman.
Sure, sure.
Part of the deal was they wanted to bring in Systematics to do all the data processing for that bank. Now, when you understand that BCCI essentially was a huge money laundering machine involved in drug money laundering,
right.
arms financing, and intelligence, then it starts to make much more sense here of what was going on.
Sure.
Now, that gets us into this whole bank spying thing, and that's how Vince Foster's picture name came up in this. And I went to Kentucky one night to interview this former intelligence guy who I was told was going to be able to fill me in on some of the uses of this software. And as we were sitting there, he was blowing smoke rings in the middle of the night, and he said, "Oh, yeah, you know, Vince, he was under investigation when he died." I said, "Under investigation?
By whom?"
What?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, it's spelled espionage."
Really?
I said, "You've got to be kidding me." And for months, I was just incredulous about this. This is nuts. That Vince Foster spying in the White House? Come on.
And the guy's really blowing smoke rings when he's telling you this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't fooling. What we did then was go back and try to corroborate this through other channels in the intelligence community, and thinking that, oh, well, we'll get this denied right away. No. It came back corroborated. Yes, Foster was under an investigation. In fact, he was under intensive surveillance by a bunch of government agencies, apparently. This was heavy-duty stuff.
Yeah, what year was this?
This would have been, I'm told it began sometime between the election and the inauguration of Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I think Foster became under intense scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have been a period of months prior to his death in July 1993.
So he was already up to his knees in espionage prior to the election.
Yeah, I'm told that he had probably had a relationship for maybe 10 years or so with the State of Israel.
And the Mossad.
Well, the State of Israel, I guess the Mossad, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They were paying big money for U.S. secrets. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no surprise about this. This is what the Pollard case is all about.
Sure.
They spy on us, we spy on them.
That's right.
We're allies, we're friends. We cooperate in many ways, but there's a lot of things we don't tell them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were paying big bucks for high-level code, particularly nuclear secrets. How else can you explain how a debt-ridden little third-world country basically has amassed one of the most potent nuclear arsenals on the face of the earth?
Right.
It wasn't by sheer luck and by accident. It was well-planned and heavily funded, and they've done well.
Mm-hmm.
If I was running Israel, I'd do exactly the same thing. But the fact is, there was they were spying on us, and people here were selling out to them.
Well, they still are spying on us.
Well, I imagine so. Now, this is the problem. Part of the way they found out about Vince was...
They being who, James?
Well, this counterintelligence group.
Okay.
Actually, it was... How this actually happened is a bit murky to me, but what I think happened was in the process of, there was the small intelligence group, computer hacker group, basically, that was out there surveilling a foreign intelligence databases, again, using this bug software.
Mm-hmm.
It would allow us to basically snoop in, and they actually downloaded like 50 databases of foreign intelligence communities.
Wow.
I mean, just about even the KGB was using this stuff, apparently, and they were able to download KGB files, which I'm told is actually how they found out about Ames originally,
wow.
going back to 1991, years before the CIA admits suspecting him.
Right, Aldrich Ames.
Mm-hmm. Right. From that suspicion, they were able to go on, and they actually found a Swiss bank account that was Foster's. Located at the Banca della Svizzera Italiana. It's a relatively small Swiss bank. Used to be affiliated with the Bank Ambrosiano.
Mm-hmm.
Now a subsidiary of Swiss Bank Corp. It's one of these kind of... It's in this town called Chiasso, which is right on the Italian border. It's A lot of funny money stuff going on there. Bollinger had actually several bank accounts at that bank, but one in particular had almost $3 million in it, which had been traced to Israeli accounts. After some surveillance, you know, they determined that this was Foster's account, that the money had come from illicit sources. And in early July 1993, July 1, 1993, Foster bought round-trip ticket for a one-day trip to Geneva and back from the White House travel office.
Right.
And mysteriously, he canceled that trip before he took it. I think it's because he found out that that money had been raided again by this computer counterintelligence group that, once they had been able to identify the money in there as his account, and once they could snoop inside the bank and actually get the authorization code off that account, they could go in and effect their own technically legitimate wire transfer of that money. And they cleaned out the account. They pulled the money back to an account at the U.S. Treasury.
So this fifth column of intelligence agents with all this incredible sophisticated computer software had cracked all the banking codes, the access codes. They drained Vince Foster's bank account just before he apparently was headed over to do something with it. And Vince, realizing his account was now Zippo,
He knew he was under surveillance. He knew the jig was up. And that coincides completely with this mysterious bout of depression that everybody claims overcame Foster. In fact, Webb Humble, his buddy and former Rose law firm partner, has never really described it as depression. He said Vince was worried. He was afraid to use the White House telephones. He was nervous. He couldn't sleep at night. He had heart palpitations. His sister tried to set him up with some psychiatrists. He never contacted any of them. Instead, he went and hired a high-powered Washington lawyer, this guy Jim Hamilton, who, guess what? President Clinton just appointed to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Very curious. There's something very fishy going on here. But the thing about this whole Foster case is, you know, Foster ends up being just a tiny bit of the picture. In fact, because the problem is he's not the only one they found with one of these Swiss accounts. They found hundreds of other high-level U.S. government officials.
And again, when you say they were talking about this group that calls itself the Fifth Column, and there are five, six guys maybe doing this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, who has actually done what here? It's very curious. I think that the intelligence community in general has known for a long time that there were a lot of these Swiss accounts. But I think the problem was there was no practical way any law enforcement agency could go after him.
Right.
Because it was a bipartisan thing. Everybody was going to help cover this thing up. No agency had enough political power to actually go nail any of these people.
Sure.
So what I think ultimately happened was this Fifth Column group, after witnessing this gridlock for years and years and years, decades I think this has gone on, they decided, look, we can do this ourselves. They managed to get a hold of a used Cray supercomputer from Clark Air Force Base after it closed.
Really?
Yes. Normally, civilians are not allowed to buy these things, partly because they're so useful for hacking, because they crunch numbers so fast.
Sure.
They can throw enough numbers at a security system, they can bust their way in just by sheer force.
Wow.
And so civilians are generally not allowed to buy these things. They got a hold of one, used, on the cheap. I think it's a small air-cooled machine that can actually be put in the back of a truck. And I think the thing is rolling around the country in what looks like a refrigerated truck with an onboard generator and a satellite uplink. Otherwise, the thing would be shut down. The feds would locate it and stop it.
Right.
So I think by doing that, for the past 5 years, they've been downloading databases. The first priority was the foreign intelligence databases. They pulled those down.
50 of them, you said, right? Approximately?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Then they went after the banks. And I think it was going through the bank stuff, that's where they really came across the Foster stuff. And then when they came across Foster's name in that Swiss bank account, then they went, I think they told the intelligence community about it, and they went back and looked through the Mossad databases, and there it is. Here's these money flows, and I guess they found something that correlated to Foster's name or code name or something.
Sure.
I don't know. But they found Foster's, something that would indicate Foster's connection to the Mossad. And guess what? Hillary, too. Hillary apparently has been under investigation for being a party to this, for taking a piece of the action off that Swiss account, and probably for providing Foster with extremely sensitive code stuff.
And how many years have they been working together? 15 years, something like that?
Well, this goes back into the mid-70s, actually.
That's right. Long time. So, all right, it's looking pretty dark for Arkansas and the Clintons and all of their retinue right now.
Yes. And, in fact, there's sworn testimony as part of the Senate investigation by Deborah Gorham, Vince Foster's executive assistant, that shortly before he died, Vince had given her 2-inch-thick ring binders that Deborah Gorham identified as being from the National Security Agency, and Vince had her put those in the safe of Bernie Nussbaum, the White House counsel.
Right.
Now, Newsweek ran this little blurb saying, oh, NSA binders, not to worry, it was just routine legal stuff from the NSA. Wrong. These were extremely sensitive binders. They had the codes, and more important than that, the protocol, by which the president would authenticate himself to the Pentagon when he ordered military action, including the use of nuclear weapons.
Those are the ultimate numbers, the big numbers.
That's right. They're not launch codes, per se. That's
right.
A different set of codes.
They're identifier codes. I got it.
Yeah, this is, you know, how the guy on the other end of the phone at the Pentagon knows it's the president calling.
Mm-hmm.
These code books should only have resided in the safe in the Oval Office or in the possession of the military attachés who carry the so-called football with them, or they could have been in the presidential living quarters. How did Vince Foster end up with these things? What was he doing with them? Did he have a security clearance for them? No, but he did have a security clearance, apparently, a relatively low-level security clearance.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is interesting because everybody denies that he had anything to do with the intelligence community.
Right, right. Jim, let's take break number 2 now. Hold that thought, and we'll continue with the story of Vince Foster, who was found dead shortly thereafter in a park, some 200 yards inside the park boundaries, with no dirt on his shoes from the park itself. Very interesting. Somebody could jump that far and commit suicide. We'll hear that story as we continue here at the end of the line. Talk Radio 990 KQSB.
I think they call that rock.
Our guest tonight, James R. Norman, who has written an amazing article in this month's Media Bypass magazine entitled Congressional Retirees Leaving Voluntarily, and We Should All Believe in Mother Goose. We are now talking about Vince Foster. We are coming up to the fatal moments here. Go right ahead, Jim.
Yeah, well, the last few days of Vince Foster's life, a very, very curious chain of events occurred there. You know, there was a strange meeting the weekend before he died. Vince and his wife, Lisa, took off to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, supposedly for a getaway weekend.
Right.
By sheer coincidence, according to the Fisk Report, they meet Webster Hubble and Hubble's wife down there.
I remember that.
Right. And so they decide, well, let's go over to Michael Cardoza's place. Michael Cardoza, he's now the head of Clinton's Legal Defense Fund. He's the son-in-law of Nathan Landau, big deal Democratic contributor, close ties to Israel. And they supposedly, according to all the official reports, it was a casual weekend of poolside chit-chat.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. This was damage control. I think at this point it was clear that Vince was under investigation, that this was heavy-duty stuff. There was concern that he was going to crack, that he was going to spill the beans. Or maybe he himself was going to decide to just, you know, go public and expose some of this stuff. And I think he became a real liability, the man who knew too much.
Right.
And Monday came and went back in the office. The record shows that he had a bunch of people come by soliciting about how the weekend went. Are you cool with everything, Vince? Everything okay? And he seemed to be calmer, as if he had resolved something in his mind. And in fact, there's a strange 2-hour meeting with Marcia Scott, one of the people in the Arkansas contingent there in the White House. Marcia claims she doesn't recall what they talked about. But they met for 2 hours in his office, very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
After which she went back and reported to her boss, Webster Hubble, that Vince had apparently made the decision that he was worried about, or that he was thinking about. Then Tuesday, the next day, Vince apparently leaves early in the afternoon and shows up dead, supposedly in Fort Mercy Park. In fact, what I've been told, and we published this in a December issue of Media Bypass, he was under intense surveillance. I mean, the Secret Service had him under surveillance while he was on the White House grounds. As soon as he left, the FBI and the NSA had surveillance teams on him.
Mm-hmm.
There's also CIA, I think, surveillance of the house, the apartment that he was renting near the White House, where he went, apparently met a woman there, I'm told, from the White House staff. Then there's also also apparently video footage of a three-person team entering that apartment, supposedly identified as being connected some way to the Mossad. That's apparently where the death occurred. Who actually pulled the trigger, I don't know, but certainly it seems that elements of the Mossad were intimately involved in knowing about it, setting it up, probably covering it up. It raises the question whether elements of our own intelligence community participated in or facilitated this hit some way. And if you go back and look at the official records, there's all of these curious anomalies. And in fact, there's an accountant at Houston, Hugh Sprunt, who's done an excellent job in just pointing out all of the telltale things in all of these official reports, which clearly, if you read this stuff in detail, you just cannot come away thinking it was a suicide the way they propose it.
Sure.
There is a stamp of national security. There's a cloak just thrown all over this thing.
It seems to me that Vince Foster represented a danger to several intelligence agencies and governments all at the same time.
That's right, because, as I was saying, Vince is like a window that you can look through to see a vast landscape of corruption. It wasn't just his Swiss account,
sure.
All these other Swiss accounts.
So,
and it's the fact that a bunch of people were participating in the sale of state secrets. And in fact, I think when the truth finally comes out, you'll see that a lot of people have been doing this stuff. They treat it as if it's a perk of office. It's like checking into a cheap motel. Anything that's not nailed down, the towels, the televisions, the pillowcases, we'll sell them.
The soap.
Yes. And in this case, the towels are nuclear secrets.
Sure. Yeah.
So,
well, you've got the fifth column, draining Foster's bank account. He becomes a tremendous liability. Vince Foster is eradicated. Thus, we have a good look at the basic MO of the fifth column. Four, five, six guys, allegedly with a Cray computer, possibly in a refrigerator-looking van, a semi, with a dish on the top, driving around the country, who knows where, parking out in front of banks, I would assume, snooping, eavesdropping, and draining them of lots of information, building these astonishing databases, including the database of over 50 intelligence agencies, which in and of itself is mind-boggling.
Well, the way that worked was that for the fifth column guys pulled down those intelligence databases and turned those back over to the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
What the intelligence community really wanted were the backdoor addresses into the banks.
Mm-hmm.
I think they initially got those back doors, but before they were able to use them, they were changed.
Right.
And new back doors were installed, and so basically this fifth column crowd has had a field day downloading bank data for about 5 years. And for the last 2 years, they've actually been out raiding Swiss accounts, the same way they raided Foster's, where you go in, you find an account, say a coded Swiss account.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly, you can't tell whose name is associated with it. But if you can get into a bank's computer files, or if you've got a snitch inside the bank who can tell you whose account that is.
And most everybody has a price, don't they?
Right. It's $25,000 or mm-hmm. so, I think,
mm-hmm.
for information on the Swiss account. I mean, well, you match that up, and then if you can track, assure yourself that the money in that account is basically dirty money. What these guys have done, they've just wire transferred this money back to the U.S. Treasury, where it's being held, I'm told, in an escrow account, escrowed for use by the CIA, but only if, and only if, the CIA gets rid of a bunch of its own corrupt bad apples there. I mean, you have to realize, large portions of the senior and middle management of the CIA has got dirty hands from drug and arms dealing. I mean, the CIA has been fundamentally corrupted by these illicit businesses that it's been running. Supposedly to further the covert, legitimate foreign policy aims of our government. But in fact, these people have been raking in the dough in their private, in their own pockets
mm-hmm.
off this stuff. It's utterly corrupt.
How much money has been brought back from these Swiss accounts? Mine, by the way, is still okay over there.
I don't know. Have you checked it in the last day or so?
Well, after tonight, I guess I better.
That's the truth. These people are even afraid to go ask to see what's in their account for fear they're going to leave some fingerprints on their
right.
accounts. I mean, it's got Washington is in utter state of fright over this.
I'll have someone else check mine then.
You're right.
Oh,
well, I
God.
Think that's how Hillary was very shrewd about this. Vince, in effect, was her bag man. Her fingerprints don't show up on this stuff,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think they had a lay-down case against Vince.
Mm-hmm.
Not so good against Hillary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why you're seeing this Travelgate and Whitewater stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Look, the crimes mentioned in these particular cases are penny-ante stuff in the grand scheme of things. It's not worth you know, bringing a president down. Right. There's white, something else underneath here.
Sure, white water is the flea on the dog's back.
Right, and so is Travelgate.
Mm-hmm.
But why were they so apoplectic about getting the professional people out of the travel office?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Vince was taking periodic one-day trips to Geneva, booking it through the White House travel office, maybe you don't want that kind of information to get out anywhere.
Right.
In fact, they've gone to great pains to not get it out. We found out about it because there was a private investigator in Arkansas who was able to get access to some of Foster's private American Express records, which showed these charges
mm-hmm.
and the refunds.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, just before Vince died, it showed he bought $2,400 of travel to somewhere from the White House travel office. He never lived long enough to take it.
Mm.
Was he going to skip the country? That's an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of ramifications.
Really?
Anyway,
right.
The take so far, I'm told, is over $3 billion. When I started on this story, it was about 8 or 9 months ago, the figure was in a range of $1.8 billion. They've just been going hog wild lately because I think time's running out. The story's going to get out. It can't go on forever, so they're just, every night they're just, you know, pulling in more money. And it's not just Switzerland, it's the Caymans, it's the
mm-hmm.
Channel Islands, it's Macau, it's all of these tax havens, all of these banking secrecy, money laundering centers around the world. They're all getting looked at because
mm-hmm.
so many of them have ended up using this boat software or systems that are easily attacked. The banking system is much more porous than anybody wants to admit. And for proof of that, about 3 months ago now, Citibank admitted that some Russian, armed with no more than a PC, managed to hack his way into Citibank's cash management system and was moving around tens of millions of dollars of cash out of corporate accounts, always keeping it in small denominations so it wouldn't trigger any internal bank alarms,
mm-hmm.
moving the money to Argentina and Finland, where he would have his buddies standing by to pick up the cash. It was only because somebody tipped off Citibank that this was going on, I think, that they got wind of it and stopped it and retrieved much of the money. But it just shows how vulnerable these banks are. In fact, what I'm told is that most major banks now are apoplectic because they're under persistent, sustained attack by the hacking community now,
mm-hmm.
looking for these same keys
mm-hmm.
to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and the banking community is utterly uptight about this.
I would think. How are the fifth columnists selecting which people to drain financially of their Swiss accounts? And then phase two, we need to explain that next, of course. Are they playing favorites of bank accounts?
I'm told, no, that they're going after the dirty money wherever they can find it. They have set a practical cutoff, though. They're not looking at anything under $500,000, which just tells you that...
I'm safe.
Well, I don't know.
$499,000, I'm safe.
You were smart. You probably divided up in between a bunch of different accounts.
I have sources, too, you know.
Okay. Smart move. Smart move. But don't go and try and move the money around, because if you move it, that tips them off, you know. Part of the thing they do, I think, is take a little bit out of somebody's account,
mm-hmm.
spook them, make them move the money to another account, and then they can track it and lay hands on yet another hoard of money.
Wow.
And so these people are uptight. They don't know where to put their money. They don't know where to put their dirty money anymore. And in fact, and I don't know if this is true or not, but you know, several months ago there was this hoopla about, oh, great terrorist threat, more security at the airports, everybody's got to get searched, turn up the settings on the metal detectors and all that stuff. There is no terrorist threat. They are looking for money,
mm-hmm.
cash. You know, there's a metal thread that basically goes through currency.
Right, sure.
Which, if you have enough bills wadded together, it's going to set off the metal detector. They were looking for cash.
Yeah, that's a little silver strip that you can see in the left side of a dollar bill, a $10 bill or a 20. You hold it up to the light, it's right in there.
Right.
Very interesting. Wow, amazing. We have to take our third break right now, Jim, and we'll continue with the rest of this first hour here at the end of the line. What a story, amazing story. We're going to tell the people next, after taking the money out of these accounts, how these politicians are being removed from office, encouraged to retire quickly. At the end of the line, Talk Radio 990 KQSB.
They're going to start wiping out all the
back with Jim Norman, whose article is in this month's Media Bypass magazine. And we should tell you, to inquire about this publication, you can call 812-477-4700. 812-477-8670. That's 812-477-8670. Media Bypass Magazine. Just full of fascinating articles. Jim Norman's is certainly the most powerful I've seen in a long time. The cover of this month's Media Bypass Magazine, by the way, Timothy McVeigh, an interview. Many articles in Media Bypass about the OKC bombing tragedy and the whole inside story on that one. This money, again, you've mentioned, Jim, is brought back here and put in some kind of an escrow, and it now is in excess of $3 billion, according to your sources. Can you tell me, without disclosing anything that would be ruinous to your efforts here, who are your sources? What are they? How credible do they rate in your history of journalism, in your mind? Obviously very high.
Well, yes, and I was skeptical about them for a long time, but they've proven themselves to be quite amazingly accurate and predictive over time.
Is this like a deep throat thing? You get phone calls, or are you meeting people face to face, or can you disclose that?
There's a couple of these people I've developed a good relationship with. We talk about on the phone,
mm-hmm.
There are ways of corroborating what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Everything we've been able to check from multiple different directions. There are a fair amount of documentary things out there. There's quite a documented legal trail on the whole Insula case.
Right.
There are voluminous public reports, the Fisk report, and there's a 20-some volume Senate report from the earlier phase of Foster hearings, which if you go through that in detail, you find all kinds of anomalies. There are vast amounts of stuff that was whited out or redacted, apparently for national security purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Other details that contradict the official conclusions. That's a goldmine of information.
We have only about 2 minutes. I'm going to hold off on phase two of the fifth columnist's actions. Phase one, take away their marbles, meaning those people that they'd like to get rid of or force out as being corrupted beyond any normalcy. Phase two is how the removal of politicians is actually achieved. And that's a very interesting and almost amusing story, which we're going to get into right after the news here. Have there been any other mysterious deaths, Jim Norman, besides Foster's in the last 6 months to a year and a half that you know of?
Well, I haven't...